The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we're going to return once again to the August 2019 edition of Our State, celebrating North Carolina. And we are going to use this opportunity of the last reading of the month to continue in the series, which is the current one running, and they run two or three of these a year and have an article in each issue. We are still in the, we did the 1940s last year. We're in the 1950s, the decade in motion. I can't wait till we get to my decade, the 1960s. But our state is looking at the people and events that shaped the 50s, and they continue with a tribe's turning point. Long live the Lumbee. The Native Americans of Robeson County are strong and proud, but their history is marked by the struggle to overcome bias. In the 1950s, a watershed moment brings national attention to the Lumbee tribe, written by Philip Girard. Through the early decades of the 20th century, the Lumbee Indians were not much known outside of Robeson County in the southeastern part of the state, though their forebears settled there by at least 1754, when an agent for colonial governor Arthur Dobbs discovered some 50 families living at the headwaters of the Little Pedee. His description was less than flattering. A lawless people who possessed the lands without patent or paying quit rents. Thus began a long history with white settlers, during which the Lumbee struggled to gain respect. Their lineage is a matter of contention, including perhaps the Hatteras or Hatorask Indians, the Tuscarora, the Saponi, the Cheraw, and the Cape Fear Indians. Whites and free blacks intermarried with them. Some believe they are descended from the settlers of Sir Walter Raleigh's lost colony of Roanoke Island, a fanciful addition to the myth of the disappeared colonists. In many ways, the Lumbee are unlike most other American tribes. They are one of the few tribes never to have been confined to a reservation. Their native language, Algonquian, Siouan, or Iroquoian, has long since disappeared from living memory, and their appearance, skin tone, and hair color varies widely and includes many fair-haired, light-skinned Lumbees. They mainly adhere to the Southern Baptist or Methodist faith. Even their name is hard to fix. In 1885, the North Carolina legislature recognized the tribe and named them Croatan Indians. In 1910, a bill introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives tried unsuccessfully to rename them the Cherokee. The following year, the state legislature designated them Indians of Robeson County. In 1913, the legislature changed their name yet again to the Cherokee Indians of Robeson County. But the U.S. Senate failed to pass a bill recognizing the name. The House tried again without success to enroll them as Cheraw or Cherokee. The Senate pursued the idea of renaming them Siouan Indians, again to no avail. At last, in 1953, the North Carolina legislature officially grants them the name chosen by tribal ballot, the Lumbee Indians of North Carolina, after the Lumbar River, or rather Lumber River, which runs through their home county. 3 years later, the Federal Lumbee Act adopts the name, but denies government benefits to the tribe. The Lumbee have long since been treated as second-class citizens and have fought for their rights just as long. In 1835, the state constitution took away their right to vote or own firearms. During the Civil War, Lumbees were conscripted into hard labor to build Confederate works along the Cape Fear, including massive Fort Fisher. Lumbee farmer Alan Lowry and his family were accused of leading a resistance movement, stealing guns, aiding escaped Union prisoners and Confederate deserters, and hiding in swamps to avoid conscription. When the Home Guard executed Lowry and his eldest son William in 1865, a younger son, Henry Barry Lowry, continued to fight, still an outlaw, long after the war's end. The Lowry band successfully eluded an armed force sent to capture them in 1870. When the legislature offered a bounty on Henry Berry's head, another militia force tracked the band and captured several members. But Henry Barry himself again proved impossible to catch. He and his band led a final raid on Lumberton in 1872. Then Henry Barry Lowry disappeared into legend. As late as the 1950s, the 30,000 Lumbee in Robeson County endure a three-way segregation and bigotry. The movie house in Lumberton seats white patrons downstairs. Upstairs, black and Lumbee patrons are required to sit in separate sections, fenced off by a barrier of chicken wire. Their children attend separate schools. Verdia Locklear later recalls those days in an interview. "You don't know what it's like to go into a drugstore. Now, I'm telling you, my experience, go into the drugstore, you're sick, you ask for a fountain Coke, and I got the fountain Coke, and they wouldn't let me sit down, and I passed out." In 1958, the Lumbee are about to become nationally famous, not for their culture or heritage or fight for tribal recognition, but for another kind of battle, a principled stand against a familiar foe, the Ku Klux Klan. Locklear is 24 years old, a wife and expectant mother, when she reads in the Robesonian that the Klan intends to stage a rally near Maxton on January 18th. The organizer is the Grand Dragon of the KKK, James W. Catfish Cole, whose stated purpose is to put the Indians in their place, to end race mixing. His followers have burned crosses in the yards of a Lumbee family that moved into a white neighborhood and a Native American woman who is said to be dating a white man. But Cole and his fellow Klansmen haven't reckoned on the determination of the Lumbee, who organize immediately to disrupt the rally. The first thing they'd say, "Be sure you got your pistol, and if you don't have a pistol, carry your rifle," Locklear says. Accompanied by her husband, Wiley, she carries her pistol to the field near Hayes Pond, where a stage has been erected, lit by a single generator-powered bulb. In the darkness fronting the stage, and in the perimeter surrounding it, some 350 armed members of the Lumbee tribe hunker down, awaiting their cue. Cole takes the stage. When he started talking in the microphone, they started shooting, then Locklear counts. One of the first shots smashed the light bulb. "It was dark. It was dark," she says. "While he didn't get far, too far from me, 'cause of all of us was shooting. They didn't let Cole talk, period. He got gone." The Lumbees rush the stage and swarm over the Klansmen, two of whom are wounded by buckshot. They were shocked because they had no dreams that we would be there like we were, Locklear says. The Lumbees seize the crosses that the Klansmen were intending to burn and make a bonfire of their own near the railroad. The Lumbees' stand turns into a jubilant celebration that lasts until 4 in the morning. The Lumbee contingent includes Charles Warhex and Simeon Oxendine, a veteran who flew more than 20 bombing missions over Germany as a waste gunner in a B-17. Known as a man who is fearless, he and Warhex tear down the Klan's white banner, emblazoned with KKK, and clown around for a photographer, wrapping themselves in it, grinning and winking for the camera. The picture is featured in Life magazine, along with a story about what's already being called the Battle of Hayes Pond. Bad medicine for the Klan. North Carolina Indians break up Ku Kluxers in anti-Indian meeting. Cole and his Klan associate, James Martin, are arrested for inciting a riot. Martin is tried in the Maxton Recorder's Court, where the presiding judge is Lacey Maynor, a Lumbee. Maynor scolds Martin before passing sentence. You came into a community with guns, where there was a very happy and contented group of people. We don't go along with violence. We can't understand why you want to come here and bring discord. Martin gets 6 months to a year in prison. Cole faces trial in Robeson County Superior Court, earning a sentence of 18 months to 2 years. Malvina Reynolds, a folk singer and political activist, memorializes the event in a satirical ballad, The Battle of Maxton Field. In one of the 9 verses, she sings, "Our histories will long record that perilous advance when many a Klansman left the field with buckshot in his pants." The Lumbee have routed the Klan and made it an object of ridicule. But the true measure of Lumbee progress is the tribe's increasing political power. Some 4 months after they send the Klan packing, Tracy Sampson is elected as Robeson County's first Lumbee County Commissioner. Soon other Lumbees assume important leadership roles beyond the tribe, on the Board of Education and as president of Pembroke State College. In 1962, a delegation of 32 Native Americans presents to President John F. Kennedy the Declaration of Indian Purpose. One of those standing with the president at the White House is a young staff member for the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights under Democratic Senator Sam Ervin. Dr. Helen Maynor Shearbeck of Lumberton, daughter of Judge Lacey Mayer, was there also. Inspired by her father's example of activism in pursuit of justice, Shearbeck goes on to become perhaps the best-known advocate of the nation for the rights of Native Americans to control their own education, working in reservations around the country, and later as director of the Office of Indian Education in Washington. She becomes a fierce advocate for education as a means of improving the lives of Native peoples. She helps ensure the passage of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act of 1975 and champions the Tribally Controlled Community College Assistance Act of 1978. She carries the fight for the rights of the Lumbee and all Native tribes far beyond Robeson County and into the halls of Congress. Coming next month, the wonder of Grandfather Mountain opens to all. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call 919-832-5138. And now we're going to read an article, the first word of the title of which I'm not completely sure how to pronounce. The word is B-E-N-N-E. I'm going to pronounce it Benny. Benny Flies High on Eagle, a new restaurant in an historic African-American neighborhood in Asheville, finds the soul of Appalachian cuisine. Written by Ronnie Lundy. Some good-looking pictures of food on these 2 pages here. When Hanan Shabazz accepted Chef John Fleer's invitation to host a Sunday supper at Rhubarb's restaurant in Asheville 4.5 years ago, neither suspected it would be the start of a beautiful friendship and the foundation for a brand new restaurant, Benny on Eagle, that has had the culinary world abuzz. What Shabazz knew and what she shared with Fleer, his crew, and his guests at that supper to honor the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday was the history of The Block, a small downtown neighborhood that was once the epicenter of Asheville's African-American community. That commercial and residential area in the city's downtown is where Shabazz, now 70, grew up and learned the ritual of her own Sunday suppers in her grandmother's kitchen and in the restaurants that once filled the block with the enticing aromas of food for the soul. "It's been pretty much a love affair since we met," Fleer says. "Hanan has been teaching me so much about the life of this community." But the block, like much of Asheville's downtown, is no longer what it was, having been gentrified into a commercial area geared more toward tourists and shadowed by the construction of new hotels. The partners behind the Foundry Hotel, situated at Eagle and Main Streets, once the nexus of the block, approached Fleer about opening a flagship restaurant in their new property. He hesitated at first, but then realized it was an opportunity to shine a light on a historic area and the largely unknown concept of African-American Appalachian food. "If I was going to do this restaurant," he explains, "there were certain things that had to be in place. I had to be able to employ people from the community, I had to have Hanan on board, and I needed to find an African-American chef to manifest that vision." Ashley Shanti, 29, is that chef, and now the restaurant's vision, an umami-rich combination of Appalachian, West African, and totally original flavors, appears on the tables like this. Ogbono rubbed pork ribs, drenched in citrus peppery vinegar sauce, and served with buttermilk britches, a crunchier, tangier take on traditional Appalachian leather britches, dried green beans, and fragrant, crumbled, cracked corn spoon bread to sop up the juices. A couple each of Akara fritters, hush puppies made from black-eyed peas, with seasoned yogurt and sorghum mustard, a meal-sized cabbage pancake, whose pedestrian name doesn't begin to describe these skillet-crisped discs spiked with sausage, radicchio, shiitake, sprouted field peas, and a creamy slather of something heavenly called mayo chow chow. Benny's menu and its concept as a restaurant rooted in a specific place and culture has turned a spotlight on Asheville's culinary scene, past and future. Right before Benny opened in late 2018, cookbook author and food celebrity Carla Hall of The Chew and Bravo's Top Chef dined in and then shouted out on Open Table that Benny was now in her top 10 of fantastic American restaurants. Food magazine profiles followed. The food website Eater lauded the restaurant for putting a focus on black regional foodways, a part of Appalachia that many haven't heard about or have forgotten. "Ah," Chef Shanti says, grinning and giving Shabazz an affectionate nudge, "I couldn't do this without her." The two are sitting side by side in one of Benny's roomy booths, trading compliments and good-natured jibes about, like old friends or family. Capped in her trademark white kufi, Shabazz's face is creased with determination and wisdom, but also plenty of laughter. Shanti wears a patterned black kerchief to hold back her crest of locks. She's decades younger than Shabazz, but she shares the same confidence and strength. The two laugh easily, and it's no surprise when Shanti says that Shabazz is like my grandmother. "But you've been my teacher," Shabazz counters. "I've learned so much from you about spices from Africa and about Appalachia from you and Fleer. We've all been learning here." The southern Appalachian region has a complex history and a tenacious mythology. Some of those myths are celebratory and some are derogatory. Some are based on local fact and others are, as we like to say in these parts, fotched on. One of the most persistent and least accurate is the story that African Americans have had little to no presence in the region. Contemporary studies of the antebellum period, such as John Inskow's Mountain Masters, Slavery and the Sectional Crisis in Western North Carolina, or Wilma Dunaway's Slavery in the American Mountain South, effectively dispute that history. A look at foodways in the region confirms the deep influence of black culture in the area. The oldest known published cookbook by an African-American in southern Appalachia was written by Malinda Russell, a free black woman born around 1819, just over the Blue Ridge in Washington County, Tennessee. She was a private cook for wealthier families in the mountains early on, married, and then became a widow. As a single mother, she ran a successful bakery and boarding house on Chucky Mountain until marauders during the Civil War forced her to flee to the north. Or consider the Drover's Road, a dusty turnpike of hog, cattle, ducks, and turkeys transported to the plantations of South Carolina for sale. It coursed through the hills of Kentucky, Tennessee, and western North Carolina, right down what is now Broadway Street in Asheville. Many drovers for these herds were young enslaved black men. The animals needed food, water, and rest about every 10 miles, as did their minders, so feedlots and simple inns grew up along the route. Enslaved and free African Americans cooked and performed many of the hospitality duties in these rough hotels, and also in the finer inns in the region that provided summer getaways for wealthy plantation families and northern industrialists. Asheville was a hub for both commerce and tourism, and when the Civil War ended, the possibility of work in both factories, like the one from which the Foundry Hotel takes its name and location, offered opportunities for the newly emancipated. Black workers were able to build homes and build up a business district on Eagle and adjacent Market Street. The area eventually became known as the Block. Like the city itself, the Block had periods of prosperity as well as lean times. During the Jim Crow era, it was a place where black patrons, barred from white restaurants and businesses, could work, shop, and gather to eat. But the destruction and construction of 1970s urban renewal accelerated the area's decline. By the start of this century, few businesses operated on the Block, and many Asheville residents knew little of the area or its history. In 2012, the publication of a dissertation about Asheville's black community from 1793 to 1900, written by local history professor Darren Waters, sparked new awareness of the neighborhood. At the urging of Waters and others, art exhibits were mounted, and organizations and individuals began creating events to highlight the Block's neglected history. Local media featured stories not only from the past, but also from Asheville's contemporary black community. One of those clarion voices belonged to Shabazz. And Benny's mottled stoneware bowls and plates made by local potter Jim McDowell, the African-American history of this corner of Appalachia is tangible, with flavors and textures telling a story. That story is told on a wall of the restaurant, too, on which hang four portraits painted by Asheville, by way of New Orleans, artist Joseph Pearson, of women who were regarded as legends of the Block. Shabazz, in her white kufi cap, is the one with the eagle-eyed gaze. In the late 1960s, when she briefly lived in New York City, her life intersected with leaders who were shaping the civil rights movement. Stokely Carmichael, Huey Newton, and Angela Davis, as well as Robert Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. She met Malcolm X at the Audubon Ballroom, and any time I had the chance, I'd feed the ones I met, she said. The lessons she learned from her mother and in her grandmother's Asheville kitchen, how to wash greens, then simmer them low and slow, how to stretch a piece of meat to feed a family, how to make cornbread, she took to the New York kitchens that she helped run, which fed anyone in the black community who was hungry. There she learned new dishes, new techniques. I bet I learned 100 different ways to cook whitefish, she says, and all kinds of things to make with leftovers. And that's also where I learned to make my bean pie, filled with a spiced puree of cooked navy beans and tasting similar to, but more delicate than sweet potato pie. Bean pies became Shabazz's specialty when she returned to Asheville. She served them at Shabazz Soul Food, which she and her husband and brothers owned and operated on the Block in the early 1970s and at the bakery where she worked after that. Her signature apple fritters were legendary in town, too. Shabazz was known to set up a kitchen to feed people just about anywhere, for a meeting or an event, or, she says, just set up in a park or my front yard. Everybody knew. That's Hannon's. Hannon's feeding us. In 2011, she became a teacher in Asheville's Green Opportunities Kitchen Ready program. The program gives students hands-on training in culinary skills while providing free lunches for people in the community. It was while she was working there that Chabaz met Fleer, who had recently opened Rhubarb. Fleer wanted Rhubarb's menu to be based on Appalachian foodways, but also to reflect on the distinct culture of Asheville, including the story of its black community. He reached out to Chabaz to create a one-time family-style Sunday supper at Rhubarb that would serve as a fundraiser for green opportunities and a tribute to the block. After that, Sunday supper became a Rhubarb staple. Rhubarb is also where Shanti met Fleer. The two were connected by Derek Hare, the chef de cuisine at Rhubarb. He knew Shanti from their time working together for Kinston Chef and PBS star Vivian Howard of Chef and the Farmer. Hare convinced Shanti to come to Asheville for 3 days and talk with Fleer about a new restaurant he wanted to open. Shanti says, "That was like the magical end to my journey. The journey began with her first restaurant gig at age 16 in Virginia Beach. My parents' rule was that you had to get a summer job when you turned 16. I didn't want a job, so I got one in this grueling, dirty, frantic, hard-on-the-body restaurant kitchen that I thought would for sure get my parents to let me off the hook, and I could spend my summer at the beach. Instead, she discovered that she liked the work and stayed on through the school year. Even after she completed a graduate degree in business marketing, she kept returning to the restaurant kitchen. Later, as a culinary assistant at Chef and the Farmer, Shanti says, I got to see the power in telling stories with food, in sharing your identity on the plate, but I knew I was not cooking from my heart, my story. And I realized I needed to go on a journey just to find out what my story even was. She and her partner, a metal worker, set out to look for a place where both could find meaningful work. A trip of several months took them to Pensacola, Florida, New Orleans, and even Copenhagen. On that adventure, Shanti began to create her dream menu, one reflecting her story. It had spices from West Africa, where her ancestors came from, alongside fresh snapped beans and flavors that echoed the seasonal produce her grandmother would cook and can at her home on the Dan River. It had her love for the mountain and the beach. When she met Fleer, I showed him my menu, and he brought out the one he'd been working on for Benny, and they had so many connections, she says. It was a monumental moment, like everything had been leading up to it, even the fact that I had a dog named Rue, pronounced like Rue, Fleer's restaurant, and that I've longed to name my firstborn Benny. The ultimate affirmation, though, has been Shabazz and her stories, her life experiences. She provides confirmation that we are indeed doing the work here in the right way, Shanti says. Shabazz jumps in to add that it's not a one-way street. She knows about the food of Appalachia, the drying of the beans, the fermenting. I didn't even think about being Appalachian until we started doing this. And she brings all these spices I've never heard of, but they're from Africa, and they make sense with what I bring. I bring soul. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I certainly hope you enjoyed it and that you'll come back and listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions, comments? Call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.